The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
The Denisons, the busiest in the biz. You do know who it is, it's Dennis Quaid. That's him.
Hi, Dennis Quaid here, and today on The Denisons, I'm speaking with country music sensation Clint Black. We talk about how he unknowingly shook up the genre when he burst onto the scene with 5 consecutive number one singles. I hope you enjoyed listening, as I enjoyed getting to know him. Dennis Quaid is here and on the Denisons, and I'm talking with Clint Black today. And I'll just run it down by the numbers. He's got a new album coming out called Out of Sane, which is a very apt title for the times, I think, the play on words. Clint's sold over 20 million albums, 22 number one singles. He's right up there with the Beatles and Elvis and everybody. Woo! 29 years of marriage to the same woman, Lisa Hartman, Lisa Hartman Black. And this is your 23rd album, is it not, Out of Sane? It's coming out... It's coming out June 19th, is that right?
June 19th. I think it's not, they're calling it the 23rd because there have been variations of albums released. So as far as studio albums go, it's fewer than that, but I lose track.
Yeah,
I'll
me
just
too.
Say it's new and it's very good according to me.
And, I do the same with my movies. You look at my filmography, and I mean, I know I've done over 100 movies, but sometimes they get me under the century mark. I don't remember all of them anyway. Sometimes I'm watching a film, and I don't remember that day and that scene.
imagine walking, and this may happen to you, where somebody wants you to act out a scene or do some piece of dialogue you had in a movie. I did a Facebook Live last night, and so requests for songs were coming in, and for a second I'm thinking, maybe I'll try. No way I'm going to remember that. You know, I've written, you know, probably 150 songs, and so you can only do 20 or 22 in a show, something like that.
Really? 150 songs?
Yeah, somewhere in that range.
For you, that seems kind of on the short side, really. So you must really take a lot of time when you write, right?
Yeah, I put out an album when I was my career first got going. They wanted one every 12 months.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, you know, how am I going to do that?
You know,
I'm doing 150 cities a year. So I put out an album about every 2.5 years. And then as it got longer gaps as my career went on, when I went independent, then it became 5-year gaps.
Mm.
So I haven't really put out that many albums, original, new material.
Yeah. Well, this is the first album in like, what, 5 years, I think?
Yep.
And why'd you take the time off this time?
Well, it's funny. That's where the album title comes from, because...
Out of Sane.
Out of Sane. You know, I like to think that, you know, the music comes out of the sane part of me, searching for truths and, you know, and feelings and all that inspiration and intellect, trying to get it all together to come up with something to say. But then you start the recording process. The tracking sessions are really exciting, as you know. All the musicians are there. Engineer is there.
The adrenaline is going.
My sessions are really loose. We have a lot of fun. We waste a lot of time laughing and joking. And then we get down to business, and everyone's all keyed up. And then when the tracking session's over, the engineer leaves. I can engineer myself doing my vocal overdubs, just like I'm sitting here at my console right now. I can do a lot of my singing and comping the vocals. I can record my guitar parts here. I can overdub other musicians myself if need be. So it becomes a lonelier time.
Mm-hmm.
And then this drags on and on, you know, working 10 hours a day here, just trying to get my parts down. And then when you move into the mixing phase, then my engineer is working from his house, and he will work for, you know, who knows, 10, 15, 20 hours on a mix of a single song. And then remotely, he'll put it onto my hard drive back there, backwards in my equipment room. It'll appear on the hard drives. Now, I can pull it up, and I have control of the mix. I can save it as, you know, CB tweaks, and then I work on that, listening and tweaking for hours and hours and hours. And then after song, it starts to become just this insanity where it's no longer art, it's science. You know, it's the science of making sure the art has its proper spaces to live in. And I'll do that for hours and hours for weeks. And then it gets to a point where I'm not sleeping. I mean, I sleep about 5 hours and it wakes me up. I feel like some crazy Jackson Pollock guy. It just becomes more and more tortured.
Or a Stanley Kubrick guy. You just go on and on forever in one scene. I mean, that's kind of like a long way from like George Jones. And I think Merle was the same way. They kind of come in. Even if they got it right, they thought on the first time, they'd just like, hey, got it. We're out of here,
that's
right?
That's it. This is the long way to answer your question. I have to be somewhat removed by time from the process to forget how tortured I was by the end in order to go back into the den, you know, and wrestle the lion. So it takes a while to get over it and want to do it again.
Yeah. I want to kind of like take you back here to learn about Clint Black, where Clint Black comes from, you know, what influences his music because of that? What's under his skin? And we'll start with like Katy, Texas. You were born in New Jersey, I think, but your dad was from Texas, correct?
Yep. He was from Jasper.
Where is Jasper?
And by the way, let me just add in here for all of you listening and for any of my fans who know me and be following me here, how fun it is. Because I'm a big Dennis Quaid. I'm a fan of both Quaids. How fun it is to sit here and have my career examined by Dennis Quaid. It's killing me.
Well,
Time I go into a Starbucks, I'm going to walk in and say, Dennis Quaid has examined my career. Give me a spiced latte.
La-la-la-latte.
Yeah.
Well,
fun. My dad was from Jasper. My mom was from Mobile, and her mom was in New Jersey. The last trimester of three of my mom's four pregnancies, she would go up there to have the baby. Mm-hmm. And then by the time each of us was a year old, we were all back in Texas, and I was the last. So we were back in Texas before I was a year old. But they still claim me up there. So
they just wanted to have
G.
New Jersey on that birth certificate, I guess, for some reason.
That's it.
Some reason. But you wound up in Katy, Texas. You know, I'm from Houston myself. I used to have a deer lease out in Katy, Texas. Now it's like Katy.
There used to be room out there
for it. Yeah, now it's like, you know, it's the suburbs, right?
Yep. You're from
Bel Air High School.
Bel Air. So we lived in Houston, Pasadena. We moved around until halfway through high school, and then we moved out to Katy. We were at West Houston Dairy, Ashford, out there at Gessner and all of that stuff.
Right.
But I used to play over in the Bel Air area. I played all over.
Oh, really?
Over there where you're from. Yeah.
Yeah.
But that would have been.
I think I was gone by that time.
1980.
Yeah. Because I'm 8 years older than you, I think, something like that. So I'd have been gone by then.
I wanted to point that out.
Yeah. But then you're like me. We're kind of like on the edge of the suburbs. It was like
there was the
town, and it kept spreading out, and you just kind of kept moving out to kind of stay.
It goes keep all
your
the
country
way to
roots.
Brookshire now.
Yeah. Pretty amazing. Yeah. That's where you started getting into music, I guess, at an early age. Picked up a harmonica, I think. It was probably the first thing. That was my first instrument, too. Red River Valley was what I learned to play, and I never got much further than that. Yeah, I bet you did get further than that.
I think Red River Valley probably came with the harmonica, the little chart, the notations for Red River Valley.
Yeah.
There was that, Old Joe Clark, and Mama's Little Baby Likes Shortening Bread.
Mama Little Baby Likes Shortening, Mama Little Baby Likes Shortening Bread.
Red River Valley and those other two, those were the beginnings for me.
But you picked up a guitar at some point. Was there a guitar sitting around the house, or was there a particular group or singer or whatever, that song that you heard that you went, I just got to learn how to play that?
It was an older brother. So I had an older brother playing harmonica, and I stole his harmonica from one time. And then I was so little, you could see it bulging out of my pocket. You know, it was just real obvious I had a harmonica in my pocket that didn't belong to me. Or was I just happy to see it? I knew I was going to run into my brother. So I decided I was going to hide the harmonica outside the townhouse. So I buried it in the dirt. Smart, huh?
Yeah.
So I buried it in the dirt. It rained that night and it was ruined. But a guy in the neighborhood came along playing. I had broken my arm. I was sitting on the porch, and he came along and played one of my favorite harmonica songs, which was Whammer Jammer by Jay Giles Band, Magic Dick on harmonica.
Yeah.
And so he played that for me, and I marveled at it, and he gave me his harmonica, and that really got me going. And then my other, that was Brian, and my brother Kevin was playing guitar and singing. And so I started trying to learn from him at 15. And I learned three chords. And from that, I could play, it was G, C, D. And from that, I could play Redneck Mother by Ray Wiley Hubbard.
Mm-hmm.
And if I reverse the order, I could play Can't You See by Marshall Tucker Band. So I ran out into the neighborhood and sang those for everyone who would listen, and that was the beginning of searching for an audience.
Your influences, you had Merle Haggard, Waylon Jennings, Willie. Of course, Willie, he was back by then, of course. But
I was also listening to, you know, we had KPFT, the public radio station, was playing, you know, Johnny and Edgar Winter, Shake Russell, Dana Cooper Band. So I was hearing you know, blues influences, and being a harmonica player, I love that stuff. But, you know, we were getting all the Cosmic Cowboy stuff coming out of Austin.
Michael Murphy
point.
And all those guys. He was playing around that time. In fact, I was just putting together before this pandemic hit. I was doing a concert I was putting together in Austin with all those guys. You're talking about Ray Wiley Hubbard, Jerry Jeff Walker, Michael Murphy, ZZ Top. You know, it was going to be
Willis Allen Ramsey.
Yeah.
Did you listen to
David
Willis?
Allen Coe? And it was going to be something. But hopefully we can get that back together again. It's going to be the return of the Cosmic Cowboys. But they were a big influence.
Playing? This is getting tough not playing. I was telling my nephew, he was asking when I was going to get back on the road, and I said, it's really tough because, you know, Lisa never stops thinking of things to, you know, work on and worry about.
All the honeydews?
So I miss, you know, singing for the audience, but it's really getting to be a lot of work staying at home. So.
Yeah. Well, that's the hardest job of all, man, she's got.
Yeah.
That's for sure. Your tours are basically going to be this year's kind of shot, I think, isn't it?
I'm still hanging on to August. I think we may have something we held on to in July. Mm-hmm. I'm still hoping to get out there in August. I think it's really going to be up to the governors and the audiences. And I saw a poll go by in my Twitter thread where someone was asking, if someone was doing a concert, would you feel comfortable going with safety measures, I guess, the way they put it. It was like a hell yes. I think it was the one I saw.
Yeah. Well, hopefully that'll be the case where we get to that point. What I'm hearing for a lot of people is that they're just basically kind of lifting the tours that they have this year and just placing them in the same time slot for 2021. I think that has a lot to do with Europe, too. A lot of people were going over there, especially. I think they just have to get that. Because you get into October, and we're into flu season again. And I don't know. We got to all come together on this thing and
Yeah.
Get us a vaccine and
the longer it goes on and the more I see, it's hard to know exactly what's accurate, but it's looking more and more hopeful. Hopefully, as we get back toward flu season again, they'll have treatments that everyone believes in, at least, if not the vaccine. And I thought, you know, people could go to concerts with masks on, with smiley faces and open mouths like they're singing along and stuff. So it would be weird.
For the concert in Austin, you know, that was back before, are we going to have it or are we going to not? Well, I said, well, we'll just all get masked and we'll put Keep Austin Weird on the front of them. But
perfect.
That became a little inappropriate, I think, by the time it rolled around. That was
drove 800 miles to the last show we had. We drove 800 miles to Kansas and woke up the next morning and the county had shut the show down. As they told us, it's going to happen. So we drove over there. We drove 800 miles.
Wow.
It was shut down. And at that point, I mean, literally that day, it was across the board, just get in the bus and come back home.
Yeah.
And so it sure is weird. It really is weird. Anyway, the influences you were talking about, both of us being from Houston, maybe the blues, the Cosmic Cowboy stuff we had there, but we had in Houston one of the best programmers in rock radio, which was Bill Young. So Bill was influencing the whole region with the programming. We probably heard more ZZ Top than some other parts of the country because they were from Houston and Dallas.
Yeah.
But
it
was a great place to grow up listening to music, just the radio stations there in Houston.
Oh, yeah. Fantastic. KILT, the radio. And they used to play such a diverse, eclectic. Well, Houston is a very eclectic place to grow up musically. Houston is sometimes called West Louisiana. You get a lot of music from over there. It's like the west of Cajunville, and you know, a lot of blues. And you know, it was also sophisticated enough that my dad, I remember, would he'd always croon around the house like he looked like Dean Martin a little bit, and he'd like to go to piano bars and croon there, and so you had all that stuff going on, and I loved his music.
There were so many places to play. There were so many joints to sing at, and I worked for a little while with a band with my brother Kevin, and then the band broke up, and I played.
What was the band called, by the way?
The Full House Band.
The Full House. Now you were the singer, I guess, right?
I was bass player.
Bass player.
And I sang some lead, and I sang harmonies with my brother, and we played everything from, you know, He Stopped Loving Her Today by Merle Haggard to Long Distance Runaround by Yes. We were eclectic, very eclectic.
And, yeah, for sure.
So we were playing the bars for a while, and all over the, and then I went solo, and I played all over the Houston area, all the way down to Galveston and up to Tomball and all over the place.
From Galveston to Tomball. Yes. Lyle Lovett's hometown. So you were the youngest of all your brothers, and so they I'm the youngest too, and so it's kind of a great place to be because you get the benefit of all their sort of like older generation. And when you're a kid, 4 years is a long time at your fingertips. You don't have, discovery is a very easy thing. You started like playing in the backyard at barbecues and things like that, then out with your brothers playing gigs. But what was it that caused the breakup of the brothers?
Well, it was me and Kevin, and then we had our lead guitarist, Gavin, who has passed away, and then the drummer, Jimmy. So Gavin was the lead guitar player, and at one point he left the band and went back to school.
Yeah.
And there was always a lot of conflict between the drummer and Kevin, and sometimes the drummer and me. So there was no real effort to keep that going. And Kevin went back to construction work.
Mm-hmm.
I did that for a little while, and then
I did too. What'd you do in construction?
Ironwork.
Ironwork.
Rodbuster. Yeah.
Rodbuster. That was, yeah. I was, I did joist work up in those, you know, apartment buildings that you'd, right out of high school.
So hot.
That was my first job. And I really knew that, well, I think I better go back to school. Because that was a hard job, man. Really tough. You were bait cutter and you were doing, you know,
That's actually not true. I had
that's a legend.
My first manager, we're sitting in his VP's office, and he's going, well, I got to get your bio down. And he made a joke about putting down, I thought it was a joke about putting down that I was a bait cutter and fishing guide. And I laughed and he laughed. And then all of a sudden I read a newspaper article and I'm a bait cutter and fishing guide.
But you had this dream. Was it really in your gut right from the start that this is what I'm going to do?
Instinctively, I knew I loved it at 15. You know, the friends in the neighborhood are saying, wow, you could really make it.
You're the best one on the block.
Yeah, you're the best guy here in your price range. You know, you could make it.
Yeah.
So I got a lot of encouragement. And by the time I was 17, I had two career paths, and one was to become an astronaut. So
same here.
I had singer's grades.
Yeah.
My plan was try to get into the Air Force and work my way into the astronaut program, a common path. But I had terrible grades, so they wouldn't have taken me. I chose the music path, not thinking that way, but in hindsight, I know now. There's no way they might have let me take out the garbage. Flying anything was not going to happen.
Hey, Dennis Quaid here. You may know that I'm a musician and a huge music fan, and I want to tell you about a new podcast that I discovered. I've been listening to Eric Krasno Plus One, a podcast hosted by Grammy Award-winning guitarist and producer Eric Krasno. I love the interviews. They go deep with musicians, and you hear stories of life in the studio, life on the road. Those are really good. Or bad, depending on which side of the story you're on. You got stories with bandmates and all the other shenanigans that go on behind the scenes. On Plus One, Eric has candid conversations with legendary musicians, many who are also his friends. And at the end of each episode, Eric plays a favorite track from his guest. So it's great for discovering new music, too. On Plus One, Eric has candid conversations with legendary musicians, many who are also his friends. And at the end of each episode, Eric plays a favorite track from his guest. So it's great for discovering new music, too. Eric's talked to people like Dave Matthews, Marcus King, Chris Robinson, and upcoming episodes feature conversations with John Mayer, Questlove, Derek Trucks, Phil Lesh, and so many more. So take a listen to Eric Krasno Plus One. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or anywhere you get your podcast. Hi, Dennis Quaid here. Hey, we all have tough days and things that interfere with our happiness or achieving our goals. If you are looking to better yourself, then you should look into BetterHelp. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P. BetterHelp evaluates what you need and connects you to your very own licensed professional therapist. You'll be connected in less than one day, and you can send messages to your counselor anytime, day or night. This is not self-help, but it is professional counseling from the comfort of your own home. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses. Plus, you could schedule your own weekly video or phone sessions. Confidential, convenient, professional, and affordable. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting betterhelp.com/Quaid. Join over 800,000 people taking charge of their mental health. Again, that's betterhelp, HELP.com/Quaid.
When did it become something that you kind of sat down with yourself and say, I got the rest of my life in front of me. What am I going to do with it? That you said, okay, this is it. This is my path.
Yeah, 17, 18 years old, right in that time period. And I knew that I might be relegating myself to a life playing in the bars, and I decided that I loved playing enough to endure that. And I played the bars for another 10 years before I got my record deal.
Yeah, you were like, what, 26, I think, when it came out?
Yeah.
Now, I myself, when I started playing guitar like at about 13, you know, and being in my room like alone because my parents were divorced, my mom worked, and, you know, my brother was ensconced in his room alone doing comedy routines on a tape recorder, and I'd be in there playing guitar. And it was... For me, I knew instinctively that I was never going to be able to shred a guitar, you know, just really go after it. I was a rhythm player, and that's what I've basically always been. And so my defense for that was songwriting, which really kind of started right from the beginning. And did you start writing right from the time you picked up the guitar?
Yeah. It was the first song is Right Where It Belongs, which is in a notebook. And I think the next song I wrote that I called a finished song went in the notebook. And then the next one I wrote went in the notebook. And those songs, I was 18 at the time. Those two songs would go on to end up on one of my records and then be released as singles and become number one singles
off of
so
that.
It was Loving Blind from the second album and State of Mind from my fourth album. So those songs sat around for a long time. I didn't even want to record Loving Blind. I wrote it with Willie or Kenny Rogers in mind.
Yeah.
And I didn't hear me doing it, but the record company loved it, so I recorded it and became a hit. I hadn't made a craft out of it. It really had to just happen to me, the songwriting.
Yeah,
and I used to look around at, you know, like Shake Russell became a friend. He was a musical hero of mine, local. And I used to look at how many songs he'd written and think, man, how do you get there? Over 100 songs. How can you do that? And then when I got my record deal all those years later, I had seen an interview with Reba McEntire talking about she doesn't write. She listens to about 1,000 songs to find 10 to go on a record.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, man, I'm not going to do that. That sounds really hard.
1,000 songs?
She would listen to find 10. So quite a search. I decided then and there I really had better get to writing. And I started trying to write out ahead of myself. And by the time I got to my second or third album, I would always have 30 songs written by the time I went in to record the next album. So I was
then you got 30 and wind up 10.
Yeah. Because I never wanted to be at a loss for songs.
Yeah, because some go
by. How many have you written? What are you at?
I can't count. I don't think I've even bothered
to count. Somebody at your age could teach you to count. Somebody could do that for you, Dennis.
Yeah, you need that counting for music. That's for sure. I've been accused.
At least
but I go through spurts. So, you know, for the last like 3 years, I've been writing a song one a month. It seems one a month, but it takes about 3 months. You know, because you get the form and everything, and then you go back over, and then you really think about it, and you kind of hone it down.
Like it tortures me. It just gets to living. It's like a radio. 6 a.m. The radio comes on, and the song's going. You haven't figured me out yet.
Right.
You better get up.
Right.
Does it do that?
Yeah. It's like tortures you. Like you got to get it done so you can get it out of your head. Right.
And then I
also feel like you tell me if you're like this, like I'll write a song and then I have to learn how to play it.
Well, I'll try recording a song and then 6 months later, remembering what you did on the song. I felt better when I saw that even the Eagles had to go back and relearn what they did when they were going to do a tour. I thought, OK, it's not just me who can't remember what I played on a record.
Well, do you have that thing where the songs have been in your head and you've lived with them for so long, and then you finally get in to record it? Do you have that thing where once you've recorded it, it sort of like drops for a while? You just like You don't listen to it. You don't think about it. You don't, unless you're on the road, that's another thing. But it just to, it's out there now. So you don't have to, it doesn't torture you.
Yeah, when it's finished, I'm sick of it. I don't want to hear that again.
Yeah.
It's just, there's no mojo left. And I produced this band, unfortunately, couldn't get their music going anywhere. But they're such a talented band and so much creativity and we're nearing the completion of their album, and they're going back and they're changing things constantly. And it dawned on me, you know, they're looking for the mojo.
Right.
And I sat down with them and I said, listen, this may be something, a new thought, but there is no mojo here for you anymore. It's gone. Now it's the science of making sure everything is living in its place. And then you put it out there and other people feel the mojo from it. And maybe if you don't listen to it for 6 months or a year, you can come back and get the mojo again, but not for a while.
So you got to play in bars and you're 18. Did you have it in your mind, I'm going to Nashville? Did you have it in your mind you were going there? I know you got picked up by ZZ Top's manager. You wound up in Nashville.
Yeah. Well, my thought first was going to L.A. and, you know, because I was, aside from being a country fan and for a while there, country music had taken a turn toward the more pop.
Well, you had the Eagles and everybody in
rock,
in the
yeah.
70s,
Jackson,
you
Brown.
Know. It was very much Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young really kind of like brought that in there. Yep. And L.A. was
That's
such a happening
I
place for music at that time. Very cool.
Well, by the time I really was primed and really ready for the break that came, George Strait, Reba, Ricky Skaggs, Randy Travis had really brought back in the traditional era. They kicked it off. So Nashville was really where I belonged. And the first song that I demoed was Nobody's Home, ended up on my first album. And that was really pure country, very traditional. So it was obvious by then where I was going. And this is 87, mm-hmm. 88 when we were doing the deal and in production. So, you know, that rock and roll had changed.
That's very interesting, too, because that's about the time in the L.A. scene that music really started to change. Having the rappers and the beginnings of hip-hop starting to come along and N.W.A. and all that. And it started shifting quite a bit. Really timed perfectly, I think. And that you were in that class of 89 that they always talk about, which Alan Jackson,
Travis Jackson.
And but the amazing thing about you were doing all of your own music that you wrote, not falling into the labels or the producers or just being influenced by, you know, the hit machine or whatever it is, kind of dictate to you what you were going to do, but you were very authentic. That's the way you come across. Listening to all of your records from your very beginnings up until Out of Sane last night, you're very much yourself. And
that's the best compliment you could pay me, by the way. And I that word authentic is one. When I was listening to a James Taylor interview, I'm a huge fan of his. And he used that word, and I thought, that's really it. That's really what that's the best thing to aspire to, is just to be authentic.
I totally agree with you about that. You used your road band on the records, which kind of hard to do. I mean, when you get in there to make your first record, how do you insist on that? How do you get around the politics of people who have decades of experience trying to tell you what to do?
With the golden ears.
Yeah.
They have the ears. You know, it really was an eye-opener, for the part of the writing the songs. I did what I did. My manager was doing whatever he was doing. The producer, the first producer we went to that wanted to do the album was James Stroud. James was a session drummer and had been becoming a producer. Now, James listened to the demos and said, you know, I want to come down and hear your band live and see if they have the chops to make the record. He did They did. So we started making that record together, and it went really, really well. Killing Time was just a big success.
Number ones, five hit singles off of your very first record. It was the very first time that had ever been done in country music.
Yeah,
I think really. Maybe the Beatles had five.
It's off a debut album. It was really a big success, and so that made a good case for repeating that formula for the second album. And then the third album, my manager kind of took what I had done and put together a recording session with session players. Now, I did that. I loved that process. I still felt like my creativity was coming out. And I would revisit later on recording with my band, but then I started to do supplementing a little bit of this and a little bit of that and really moving around. But
by this time, you're really getting a lot. You're getting very experienced of working in a studio and know kind of a sound and how to get it what you want.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the songwriting was the most surprising part. I'd written all of my songs. I was having all these hits, and there was starting to become pressure from the record company to record outside songs. So these are songs that they would find me, and I just refused to do it. I had plenty of songs written. I couldn't wait to record. It really became a battle and a point of contention between the label and me. And I had to, at one point, I'd written a song called Like the Rain, would be a hit off as an extra song off the greatest hits. And the head of the record company didn't like the second verse. I went to James Stroud and I said, you know, I like my second verse. He said, it's easy for you to rewrite a second verse. Just do it. He's the head of the label. Just do it for him. So I did it and he liked it. And I went in and I said, listen, I want to be a great adhesive in this relationship, but I have to understand why it's so important for you that I record outside songs when we've had so much success with my songs. You know, it's what brung us to the dance, as they say. And what he said next would just break my heart, because it wasn't about the success of the music or the quality of the songs. It was about politics, as you called it. And he said, they just want a little taste. Mm. And by they, he meant the publishing community. Mm-hmm. They wanted their little piece of real estate on my records. Mm-hmm. And it turned me into the record company's problem child, because I wouldn't do that. And I finally, you know, when that deal was up, I went independent. I met with major labels. And by then, I had a reputation of being that problem child who doesn't play ball.
You're talking about RCA. And, that was your first record label, correct?
Yeah.
Right, there at Music Row?
You know, and to their credit, I delivered the records and they put them out. But they began, the head of the record company began to really resent and started saying bad things about me to some of the radio programmers and the promotion people. And it really painted me in a light of being difficult, when all it really was is I record my own songs. Part of the way they market records is through award shows, and they work on trading votes around. Mm-hmm. If you've got some stake in whether my album's a success, it'd be easier for you to give a block of your votes, you know, if you'll give us Entertainer of the Year, we'll give you Male Vocalist of the Year. And they do a lot of that, and that's probably typical in all the entertainment venues. But that's part of what drives their marketing, and I get it. I never really begrudge them. It's your business. Just, you know, let me out of this deal, and I'll do things the way I've always done it.
You just write and play.
Well, if you look at what I built here on my property, it's a full scale recording studio, and that's my love of doing this. Mm. And you know, throughout my career, I've put everything I have back into creating a place to write and record music. And I think that people who are just driven by the commerce, that they really can't appreciate that, and people who are just driven by the art sometimes can't appreciate their side of it.
Yeah.
And I made the argument, you know, we've had a lot of success here. You know, Killing Time was all written by me, co-written with my guitar player, half of it, and that should be, that should give me the right to keep my job.
Right.
But if,
Well, once again, the issue is authenticity. You were a relatively young age, I guess. With Killing Time, you were, 25, 26?
Yeah, by the time the album came out, I was 29, I think.
Yeah.
28.
So you go from kind of relative obscurity, I guess, and then all of a sudden you're Clint Black. I can't believe it's Clint Black right here. So how did you handle that, man?
I thought I handled it well, but knowing how I deal with that kind of excitement, you know, when someone screams your name and that's
what did that feel like the first time that started to happen to you?
Well, everywhere I went, it's not like one person does it and you can go, hey, come on over here and settle down. And everywhere I went was an event. It was fanfare. It was a concert. It was a radio station with contest winners all around. So it felt a little bit Beatles-ish, Elvis-ish, on a smaller scale.
Did you feel like you deserved it?
I always tried to view myself for the guy I see in the mirror and not put on any rose-colored glasses and get the big head and all that stuff. I felt like my music was good enough to warrant the success it was getting, but I tried to keep my feet on the ground.
It's good that you felt like you deserved it. I mean, there's like it happened to me. Like I made Breaking Away, and when that came out, I remember being in New York and I was at a pharmacy or something, and some lady was in the aisle and she recognized me. It's the first time I got recognized. She had her two sons, and she just kept following me aisle to aisle, and it was just like I freaked out. I freaked out about it because it was just like. I wasn't ready for it. Nobody teaches you how to be a success, but you've always it seemed like you've always been a regular guy. You just that's the way I think it's in your bones that you're a regular guy. And I like to think that I am too. And I think I've learned how to handle success, but I didn't handle it really well at the beginning. And you kind of made it through without scandal, without any big faux pas, and elegantly.
Appreciate that. I can see my flaws and I can see my mistakes. As we were talking earlier today, the day will replay itself at night in my head before I fall asleep to make sure that I become aware of something stupid I said or some mistake I made if I didn't catch it. So I see me for who I really am, but I did pretty well stay out of trouble.
How'd you manage that in all the bars and everything?
Lucky, I missed that craze. It was here in Nashville too, but it wasn't thrust at me.
Yeah, you're 8 years younger than I am, so yeah, you kind of missed the 70s on that part. It was kind of the 80s.
Yeah, and I watched George Jones's career. Now, my dad was a huge George Jones fan, so you know I was indoctrinated with George and with Merle, and I remember being on stage when I was 18. We were playing a bar over near where you're from, over on Richmond, and I was playing bass, and I was in the center position on stage, and people used to send us up drinks, you know, so we're drinking and playing, and my brother. Is over here to my right, and it's at that point in the evening where we've been overserved, and I remember seeing my brother go by me back here at about this angle. You know, he was launched, so he was on his way to the ground. Going by the song. and he ran into a stool with a bunch of drinks on it, and a shower of turkey and Coke went over the drum set. And
sounds like one of my early movies.
What came out of that for me was, if I'm not careful, I'm gonna be another George Jones. If I'm lucky enough to have success, then that's how I could end up. And I never drank on stage again. And I always just had this mindset of, this isn't my party. I'm not going to be partying on stage. And it straightened me up. You know, I would have, at the end of the night, I would have a shooter or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, but not with more than one song left to play. And so that really woke me up. And maybe that had a lot to do with the next 10 years of playing the bars were not a blur. They were, I was trying to be a professional, and I'll give credit to brother.
Well, you certainly have been a professional, I mean, all through. I mean, do you have a faith that kind of carries you through these times?
You know, I have been a seeker, a builder of faith, and I've studied and prayed on it quite a bit, and ridden. That's past tense for read. If you're from my
yeah.
brain, read and I like to say my bridge has not been completed, but it's under construction.
Right,
and I do believe that that we're accountable. And, you know, I've read all the teachings of, well, not all, but I've tried to study enough of it to learn from them, to learn from the Bible, the old and the new, to learn from, Buddhism and, Judaism and tried to build something at least to help me bridge the gap between what I know and what I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that's helped to make me into a good, responsible, caring, sensitive person and someone who I hope to be on a path. I believe that the fundamentals of prayer are not so that God hears our words, but so that we hear them.
Mm-hmm.
And that we connect with our inner soul, which if there is a divinity, it's part of that divinity, and we're either connected to it or we're not. Kind of like the Carlos Castaneda, you know, books, The Art of Dreaming, and all of that. You know, I believe there's something to that connectedness with our soul, and that's. To me, what the fundamentals of prayer are is to connect with our soul so that when it ascends, our consciousness goes with it, and that's what keeps us connected. And so I've tried every way I can to bridge that and keep that that connection.
Yeah,
but I'm still a work in progress.
Well, that's what my mother said. God's not through working on him. That's the thing I heard somebody say about prayer one time, that it was like, you know, saying prayers, like it's not like God is here to serve you. You know, you ask for prayer. It's like we're here to serve God, and to keep that in mind when we pray for things. And but that it's. You have principles in your life. It just seems like you're imbued. Like I said, you're a regular guy. You seem to feel kind of calm. There's a peace about you and a regularness about you, and you're not you don't try to put yourself above anybody, but you don't try to put. It feels like you're not, you know, put yourself below anybody either. You know, and. I admire that. I wish I had that kind of evenness sometimes in my life. I have so much drama, it seems, sometimes, but or I have had.
Well, man, I appreciate that, and I have my own drama, and I'm not, you know. Fortunately, you seem to have seen the better parts of me, and like I say, I know who I really am, and I'm as flawed as anyone,
yeah.
And I was fortunate, you know. You know, you talk about my marriage.
That was the next thing I was bringing up. So, yes.
Yes. So I married a lady about 2 years into my celebrity.
That would be Lisa Hartman.
With all that.
Yeah.
Yep. So Lisa Hartman and I met on New Year's Eve in Houston at the Summit at my New Year's Eve concert. And we were married 10 months and 20 days later. And so.
How'd you guys meet? Tell me how you guys met.
okay. All right. It's kind of a fun story.
This time she's a TV star, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And I had no idea who she was because I didn't watch the nighttime dramas and I didn't watch the
movies.
Well,
we all did.
I didn't see any of the movies. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I hadn't seen her movies and I'd been oblivious and really there was I was on tour. I was opening for KT Osland and her manager was Stan Maress. Now, Stan's partner was Herbie Nannis, who was Lisa's manager. And so Stan gave Lisa my cassette and said, "You have to listen to this kid. You'd really like him." And so that's her introduction. Meanwhile, unbeknownst to Stan, Fred Rappaport was the head of specials and married to Michelle Lee, who was on Knots Landing with Lisa. So Fred is the head of specials for CBS, and I'm doing specials on CBS by then and know Fred. And Fred says, "You really need to meet this lady, Lisa Hartman." So how those two people, you know, put us together.
And you both had to come back to Houston to meet each other.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah. So when Fred said this to me, Lisa and her mother, Johnny, had come to my New Year's Eve show. They went back to Houston for the Christmas holidays, and they came to my show, and I met them briefly backstage. And it was one of those moments where I'm meeting Lisa, and it's like her blue eyes. I went, you know, just zoomed in. And, wow, look at those. And I'm just meeting this just incredibly beautiful woman. She was really sweet. There were 100 people backstage, and she just said a quick hello and said, "You have a lot of people to see here, so I'm going to let you do that, but nice to meet you." And that was it. And then I'm doing a special for CBS, and Fred comes backstage and says, "You have to call this Lisa Hartman, and I'll give you her phone number, but only if you promise to call her." So he gave me her phone number, and I was out doing the Tonight Show, and I called her up, and we went to dinner, and that was that. We pretty much hit it off and started seeing each other, and we were married that year.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
crazy.
Yeah. So what wound up being from that? Did you change locations and move out to LA?
Well, I had bought a house in Nashville that year. And so we were just back and forth. She had a house in Laurel Canyon.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were back and forth. I was on the road a lot. She probably shot 6 movies that year. Yeah, it was flying out to wherever she was.
Getting busy. And then you waited, I guess, about 9 years before you even had you had your first child. So, yeah.
So we had Lily in 2001 and sold the house in California and settled here in Nashville.
Yeah.
And that was 18 years ago.
Wow.
Yep, it's been but the thing I wanted to say about who I am and whatever it is that you see you were so generous with me on came out of, I think, when she and I got married, if I had time off, I went reclusive. I need to get away from being that guy, because everywhere I went I was that guy, and it was overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to New York City. I think I was working, doing a TV show or something. She was promoting something. We went to New York, and she said, "Okay, so what are we going to do?" And I said, "Do? I'm going to sit here in the hotel room like I always do." And she said, "Oh, no, we need to go." And she had all these things to do, and so whether it was there or L.A. or Houston or Nashville, wherever it was, if we needed to go to the grocery store, we're going to the grocery store, because that's the way she lived her life. She had already dealt with celebrity and all that, and she really forced me to live a life. And Yeah, I tell you, it makes me a little weepy thinking about who I might have been had she not insisted that we live our life.
Forcing you to get out in the world, you know, just realizing, well, maybe I am the regular person. They're just like us.
I look back on those times and I think, man, there's no way it seemed as calm and cool as collected as I thought I was acting. There's no way.
Yeah.
Because, man, some of it was just craziness. And as the years went on, I would think, you know, no, now I'm calm, cool, and collected. Now my rudder's deep and I'm doing okay. And then I would look back, you know, 5 years, 10 years later and look back on that and go, no, I still was not there. I'm still trying to settle into this life.
Well, you had marriage and you took the first time that you really took real time off from recording and the business was when Lily was born. And you did that. I think John Lennon did the same thing. But when Sean was born, you took 5 years off just to be a dad.
Yeah.
And be around.
Yeah, I had read a book on parenting and as frightened people will do.
Yeah.
And one of the things that really stuck with me was the term secure attachment. And that was, if you want to be a secure attachment for your child, you know, you have to be there during the bonding years.
Those first 6 years, right?
Yep. And so, you know, I always said, you know, when the thunder claps, you know, will they reach for you? And I really wanted that. I really wanted... Mm-hmm. I wanted that bond, and so I took those years off, and it wasn't good for my career. But as you know that's a backseat compared to parenting and having a closeness with your child. It really was the thing.
Yeah, that, I had the same thing with Jack. He was born like in 92, and mine wasn't actually like chosen to take so much time off. It's being with him is like, you know, there's always going to be another movie or another job, hopefully, even though we think we'll never work again after each one. But they're never going to be two again. They're never going to be three again. And you miss that. And what was the name of that term about bonding?
Oh, secure attachment.
Secure attachment, yeah. It was the thing. It that goes along with giving a child I think the most important thing during those years is to give them a good sense of self-esteem of about them, feel good about themselves, and
you're going to care about that more than anyone.
I wouldn't give it up. I wouldn't trade it for the world. And you know, it does cost you something maybe out there in the world, but, you know, that's the way it is, and we're doing just fine. So you recorded your record. And now you did your Christmas record, too, eventually, and you worked with a family member of mine, Gene Autry, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he's my cousin.
I actually did that. Oh, man, I did that for a cartoon of Rudolph.
Yeah.
So he was a cousin. How are you related to Gene?
He's my grandfather's first cousin. They were in Oklahoma. It was my grandfather's first cousin, and you know, they used to hang when they were kids. They grew up together, and my dad's, you know, second cousin and be my third. I met him at the opening of Wyatt Earp back in 1994, and so it gets me free Angels tickets anytime I want.
he was like the Elvis of his era.
Dollar for dollar. I mean, in modern terms, he's probably the most successful entertainer of all time. He made those movies, and he wrote Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, Back in the Saddle Again, Frosty the Snowman. He bought KTLA, that TV station, one of the first independents that was huge, and then bought half of Anaheim along with Walt Disney. And so he was doing all right when he checked out. Very innovative. But anyway, to get back to your last album then was 2015. What brought you back? When did you start writing the songs for Out of Sane?
You know, a couple of them are old, and they've just been sitting in the pile. And but, you know, I've kind of written a little here and there. I think, you know, I'm still doing about 80 cities a year, so I'm real busy touring. And then I always break around Christmas time and take off until the spring. Mm. And so that's when I start getting the itch. I have this studio, and it starts calling. And so,
isn't that great to have that itch still? That fire, fire in your belly about it?
Yeah, and I tell you, I sitting here today, having this album's just about to come out, I don't know if I could make a record next year. I don't know if I could make one the year after, because the process, you know, if I weren't touring, then I would have to make a record. But I'm going to be touring, you know, knock on wood.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, when you do a movie, if it's a long shoot, I don't know, some movies are a month, right? Or depending on your role, it may be less than that. But you must shoot some movies that take a lot longer, right?
What's the longest was The Right Stuff, which is also my favorite film that I ever did. It took 9 months, and I didn't want it to end. I was like you. I wanted to be an astronaut when I was a kid, and I was playing Gordo Cooper, you know, one of the originals, who was my favorite astronaut back then. So that was the most, but probably the same as you. When I finish something, I don't leave anything on the table. You got to run to the tape and just, you know, give it everything. And I'm so grateful that I still have more fire in my belly now for doing it than I think I did in my 20s when I first started out, because I think I appreciate it so much more.
Yeah, I look at guys, you know, Willie still out there, Charlie Daniels. I go see James Taylor in concert or Eric Clapton. And you look at those bands, you know, and the musicians on stage are as old as the, you know, the front man.
Yeah.
And I go, okay, well, you know, they're in their 70s. Charlie's in his 80s.
Yeah.
And they can still get up there, and some of them are better now. I'm better now at what I do. I'm mm-hmm. a better musician than I was 5 years ago or 10 years ago. And they tell me in their, you know, example that if I stick with it and don't get rusty, you know, I can. And the better you are, the more satisfying it is to do the work.
Yeah. And Charlie Daniels, man, what a guy. I had the pleasure of sharing the stage with him one night. What a man, as they say.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, how did you come up with Out of Sane? What does that mean to you?
It's an ambiguous term, right?
Yeah.
So we know sane and insane, mm-hmm. but out of sane, you know, I thought it really spoke to the sanity and insanity that is involved for me making a record, just because it's just so many hours, and you know, near the end, it's torture. You know, it's no sleep. And it's, you know, it's all science. So you're really a scientist. I mean, I'm making, you know, little adjustments that are down to 10th of a dB. You know, I'm really, maybe I'm a little more.
Maybe you're a perfectionist.
No, I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't say that. I had a guy test me once. I had a guy that I was working with who said, you know, well, I've talked to everybody you work with, and it looks like you're a perfectionist. And I said, and I had read about that. You know, I used to read psychology books, and I was a little bit of a student of human behavior, and I didn't want to be a perfectionist. I knew it wasn't a healthy thing. And so he made me take an online test.
Yeah.
I took an online test, and I said, he goes, you're going to take a test, a psychological evaluation. Because you're a perfectionist. And I said, well, what if I cheat? And he said, oh, they know all the cheats. Yeah. You're not going to cheat. So I took the test, and he had to come back around later and tell me
that you'd failed it perfectly.
Right, you failed it. And I said, here's the difference. I said, I'm striving for excellence. And doing that, my train's here. I got to go. Now, in doing that, I thought I had my phone off. In doing that, in striving for excellence, I might get lucky and hit perfect every now and then. but that's all it is. Every now and then you might.
Yeah.
But striving for excellence is a healthy thing.
It's the only way you'll get there.
Yeah, I was just saying, and I'll probably butcher it a little, but it was something like amateurs practice until they get it right. Professionals practice until it can't go wrong. And I thought, yes, that's who I want to be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the first time I've ever heard excellence. That. That's perfect. Well, you are always striving for excellence. You're inspiring, man. You really are.
Well, thanks. Well, right back at you.
And I wish you luck. New record, Out of Sane. I listened to it last night. We were texting back and forth, and I appreciate you sending it to me. It's just, man, you're better than ever. And you're a force.
I appreciate
you
that.
Really are. And Ed, I want to come see it live and in person next time I can. And see Lisa backstage.
Well, I hope you will.
Give her a big hello for me. We auditioned for Grease 2 together. We didn't get it, but
yeah.
That's the way it goes.
But the way she remembers it, you guys read with each other.
Yeah.
So y'all would have,
that's
you know, wouldn't that have been fun if you guys had ended up in that?
Well, if it could have, should have, would have, if only. That's the way it goes.
Yeah.
But
well,
man,
let me just say, I'm so honored you listened to that album. I've watched you for so many years, and this, you know, last night and today, this is the first time we've met, and I've been a fan of yours and just watched you, enjoyed you. Even my daughter, we all watched Parent Trap, and Lisa said, "Are you're doing your thing with Dennis Quaid today?" Right, and Lily goes, from Parent Trap? Yep.
The Parent Trap Dad?
Yes, from many things. He's, you know.
Well, tell her, let's get
Dennis
together. Yeah.
Yep.
Dennis Quaid from Houston.
And I'm honored
Clay
you,
Black from
you,
Houston.
You listened to that, and really appreciate it. And, you know, all these kind things you've said, you know, mean a lot. It means a lot coming from you. I know you've been paying attention to music and all of this stuff for so many years. So,
well,
as a musician, that means a lot.
Next time I'm in Tennessee, I want to come out there. I'd love to get together, man. And
by and we'll stay in touch and get past this this barrier someday.
Yeah. Well, just keep going, Clint. Because we need you.
I will.
We really do.
I will. You
too. Congratulations, man. The music is fantastic.
Thanks. And I thought about your song title for your song. I don't know if America.
America, I love you too.
Yeah, it's like we were just writing answer songs for each other. I have America still in love with you, and you have I love you too. So we've got our Hallmark card already filled out.
Well, let's get together and play next time I come over. I'd love to just sit on the porch and we'll play just for the heck of it.
Let's do that.
All right, pal.
All right.
You take care,
you
man.
Be well, and we'll hope to see you soon with without the mask.
God bless you and yours. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of The Denisance. Please make sure to rate, review, and of course subscribe so you can get new episodes delivered straight to your podcast player. Hey, and make sure to tune back in next week. Ooh, la, la. Audio up.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.